This is 40ANM In5, a download of 40ANM LLC, recorded at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday, March 24th. I'm Chris Bohm, and welcome back to this, our weekly selection of tech sector and related global news and policy highlights from the past week. Coming up, Viacom and Google settle over long-running claims of copyright infringement on YouTube. The Federal Reserve scales back quantitative easing, and Fed Chair Janet Yellen talks interest rates. Computer World reports on first-of-its-kind data breach settlement in Florida. Latest surveillance revelations reported by the Washington Post outline NSA capability to record and cache every phone conversation of a target country. And New York Attorney General takes aim at high-volume computerized trading and special services from exchanges. But first, in late April of last year, U.S. Southern District of New York Judge Louis Stanton granted summary judgment to YouTube, rejecting a theory from Viacom that YouTube had red flag knowledge that made it liable for content uploaded by its users. That ruling came nearly a year after the Second Circuit Court of Appeals reversed Judge Stanton's earlier decision, made in 2012, to dismiss the case. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act grants safe harbors from potential copyright claims to site owners, provided that the sites give copyright owners a way to have infringing content removed, and as long as the site is not complicit in user copyright violations. Viacom had hoped to narrow the scope of the DMCA safe harbors by drawing attention to a part of the law that would find liability where a site owner is willfully blind to violations. This past week, the long-running saga, a dispute between the companies that began ostensibly in 2007, is apparently at an end. Viacom has been seeking as much as $1 billion in damages from YouTube, but word traveled quickly that the companies had settled. Google acquired YouTube in 2006, and it has settled many similar disputes with content companies thanks to its shared revenue model, in which advertising is displayed alongside copyrighted content, with a share going to both Google and the copyright holder. The terms of the deal between Google and Viacom were not disclosed, but in a joint statement, they announced, "This settlement reflects the growing collaborative dialogue between our two companies on important opportunities, and we look forward to working more closely together." The U.S. Federal Reserve has said that it will scale back its bond buying program, which began in late 2008, early 2009, by a further $10 billion per month, bringing the Fed's monthly bond buying down to $55 billion from $85 billion, the level where it was at this time last year. The move also came with remarks from Fed Chair Janet Yellen, who signaled that the Fed could possibly begin interest rate hikes within 4 to 6 months following the close of the bond buying program. When the Fed lowered its overnight interest rate to 0% in December 2008, it also began its program of buying bonds shortly thereafter, aiming to keep long-term borrowing costs low. The move, called quantitative easing, has been a staple of the Fed's efforts to stimulate economic recovery, and Yellen's predecessor, Ben Bernanke, had begun the slow tapering off of the program in view of U.S. economic growth in mid-2013. The Fed had previously signaled that it would begin raising interest rates when the jobless rate fell to 6.5%, but labor market conditions, indications of inflation pressures and inflation expectations, as well as readings on other financial developments, could support such a move. If the bond purchases end in late 2014, as expected, by Fed Chair Janet Yellen's remarks, rates could increase as early as April 2015, although analysts caution that a lot economically could happen between now and then. Rarely does one magazine seem to scoop a legal story, but Computer World seems to have done that this past week. On March 17th, reporting on a little-discussed federal district court settlement reached in Florida on February 28th. In December 2009, laptops belonging to AvMed, a Florida-based health insurer, exposed the patient records of thousands of its customers, with several victims later filing a class action against AvMed. According to Computer World, the plaintiff suffered no direct losses or identity theft from the data breach, but instead accused AvMed of negligence, breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, and unjust enrichment. The U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida dismissed the claims against AvMed twice, but on appeal to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, several of the claims, including the negligence and breach of contract claims, were sent back for rehearing, according to Computer World. When AvMed again filed a motion to dismiss, the district court this time refused, which prompted AvMed to seek settlement talks with the plaintiffs. Thus, the settlement reported on by Computer World is likely the first case in the U.S. to compensate victims regardless of whether they suffered direct financial harm from a data breach. Under the agreement, reported by Computer World, each victim will receive up to $10 for each year that they paid AvMed an insurance payment, up to a maximum of $30, as well as actual damages to any victim whose identity was stolen. In addition, AvMed must install GPS tracking on its laptops, as well as new password protocols and disk encryption. On Wednesday of this past week, the Washington Post reported that the NSA has developed a surveillance measure capable of recording the entire content of all of a country's telephone calls. The program, called Mystic, apparently began in 2009, according to the Post, and the NSA's emblem for the program is a cartoon wizard with a long white beard, cowl, and pointed hat, carrying a wooden staff topped by a mobile phone. According to the Washington Post, the Mystic program is also accompanied by a tool known as Retro, short for retrospective retrieval, that enables the agency to look back, retrieve, rewind, and parse all of the calls. After going live, the program reportedly reached its full capacity against the target country in 2011. According to the Washington Post and the documents at its disposal, the initial deployment of the program stores the billions of call recordings in 30-day rolling buffers that clear old calls on a first-in, first-out basis. And while analysts may only listen to a fraction of 1% of the calls, millions of voice clippings, called cuts, are sent for processing and long-term storage. At the request of U.S. officials, the Post did not release any detail that could identify the target country. It was noted by the Washington Post, though, that ubiquitous voice surveillance, even when undertaken overseas, pulls in a great deal of content from Americans who telephone, visit, and work in the target country. And that fact may be seen as inconsistent with the pledge made by the President in his January 17th address that the U.S. is not spying on ordinary people who don't threaten our national security, regardless of their nationality. Most of the bulk collection surveillance programs detailed to date, though controversial, have involved metadata and not call content. And as highlighted by the Washington Post, with up to 30 days of recorded conversations in hand, the NSA can retrieve an instant history of a subject's movements, associations, and plans. And in addition, access to the Retro tool is reportedly made available to other U.S. intelligence agencies, although these were not named. Back in September of last year, Elise Hugh of National Public Radio's All Tech Considered reported on a mystery that arose just after the Federal Reserve announced on September 18th that it would not be tapering its bond buying program. The Fed has since changed course, of course, but that news of the Fed's announcement took literally 7 milliseconds to reach Chicago. However, according to NPR at the time and trading data analyzed by CNBC, some $600 million in assets changed hands on Chicago exchanges roughly 2 milliseconds, faster than the speed of light, before news of the Fed's decision reached Chicago. To put this in perspective, at the time, the exchange of $600 million in assets contrasted sharply with the very low volume of transactions that occurred before the Fed announcement. And in an op-ed written briefly after by Neil Irwin of the Washington Post, he wrote, "In the high-frequency trading business, billions of dollars are spent on high-speed lines, programming talent, and advanced computers for funds looking to capitalize on the smallest and most fleeting mispricings. These computer resources and the insanely intelligent people could be working to make the internet run faster for everyone or figuring out how to deliver electricity more efficiently." Well, it seems that some folks out there are starting to agree with him. New York's Attorney General, Eric Schneiderman, is calling for curbs on services often provided by exchanges themselves to high-frequency traders. The services permit these traders to have faster access to information, enabling rapid and often risk-free trades before the rest of the market can react. Sophisticated computer programs can enable high-frequency traders to both buy and sell in milliseconds far more rapidly than any human trader, and they are also benefiting from privileged access to information such as pricing, volume, trade, and order confirmations before other investors. Attorney General Schneiderman highlighted that if a firm can detect a large order from an institutional investor like a pension fund, it can instantaneously position itself on the other side of that trade, driving up prices artificially. fundamentally unfair and potentially illegal, he called it. In May 2011, computerized trading was blamed for the flash crash that had sent markets down by 5% in the U.S. before a computer error was detected. And the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, or CFTC, is also reportedly looking into potential regulation of high-frequency trading practices, according to BBC reporting on the story. And here are a few notes for the coming week. This coming week in Brussels, the European Union will host President Obama for his first visit to Brussels and to the EU institutions, and his first visit to Europe since 2011. The visit, which will take place on Wednesday, the 26th, is following an invitation by the President of the European Commission and the European Council President. Also scheduled for the coming week, from Monday through Wednesday, members of the European Parliament will meet with members of the U.S. Congress, the U.S. Treasury, and supervisory authorities in Washington to discuss the role of financial services in the transatlantic trade and investment partnership, macroeconomic policies, and the fight against tax evasion. Several members of the European Parliament have also scheduled to take part in several open forums with U.S. officials in Washington at various times between official meetings throughout the week. And that will be all for us this week. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from The Washington Post, the BBC, and Computer World. Thank you for listening. 40ANM and 5 will be back with you again on Monday, March 31st. Until then, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.